K invites you to tune into The Global Village, weekdays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Bringing you a global mix of hosts, seeking the universal soul and making musical connections between our geographical and musical cultures. That's The Global Village, KPFK's flagship music program with new and familiar voices, Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., right here on 90.7 FM and online at kpfk.org.
This is KPFK 90.7 Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, worldwide on kpfk.org, Southern California's original public radio station, hitting the airwaves since 1959. Publicly funded and made possible by you, the listener. You shook me all night long.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Today we talk to veteran journalist Mark Cooper about the landslide that wasn't, Trump's transition swamp, the state of the Fourth Estate, otherwise known as the media, already starting to go easier on the Trump train. Trump has no mandate. His so-called landslide is confined to the very undemocratic Electoral College. His margin of victory of the popular vote is 1.6 percentage points, the smallest in more than 20 years, about 2.5 million votes out of 152 million cast. Trump may claim an historic, unprecedented mandate, but he didn't win an outright majority of the presidential vote. He's still dangerous, but vulnerable. And Mark Cooper insists that the Gates withdrawal is a defeat, even if a small one. We'll talk about the dangers and the chaos to come, the survival of formal democracy, and more when our program returns in just a moment. Welcome back to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. We continue our post-election blues and analysis today with veteran journalist Mark Cooper, who writes the indispensable Coop Scoop. We'll have more on that in a minute. Trump's so-called landslide has now morphed into a much smaller win, except in the Electoral College. The LA Times calls it the landslide that wasn't. His margin of victory on the popular vote will be probably around 1.6 percentage points when all the votes are counted. And it's the fifth smallest of the 32 presidential races held since 1900. Some pundits have said more people in 2024 voted for a candidate not named Trump than did. And yet, Trump's trifecta in our system is a big win. While Biden is still president, all the airtime, indeed all of the political air, is being sucked up by Trump coverage. So if you forgot what that was like from 2016 to 2020, you're getting a daily reminder. And for now, all of the attention is on the cabinet picks, a slew of loyalist opportunists, corrupt to the core. One strains to remember the de rigueur so-called presidential behavior or decorum of the pre-Trump era. And yet the worst of the picks, Matt Gaetz, appears to be a step too far, even for Trump. An alleged pedophile sex trafficker is a little bit much for the top cop job. And as Mark reminds us, the Gaetz withdrawal is a defeat, a small one, but a defeat. We're going to talk about all this and more, including the survival of formal democracy and the state of the Fourth Estate, that is, the media, in just a minute. Mark Cooper, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So let me just tell people, in case they don't know, Mark is a veteran journalist, a former staff writer at The Nation. He's a retired USC journalism professor, an expert on the media, and he's written several books. Now he reads, as I called it, the indispensable must-read newsletter called The Coop Scoop, and that is thecoopscoop.substack.com. Well, Mark, with all of that free promotion. Let's just
all our problems are solved.
Yeah. So you're going to get rich, right? But no, right. Let's go now, because we can't help but start with, I guess, the end of what I just said. And I was actually quoting you in a recent Coop Scoop. You said Trump has no mandate. He's dangerous, but very vulnerable. And the Gates withdrawal is a defeat, a small one, but a defeat. So let's begin with that. Explain.
Well, the Gates candidacy is the shortest in history. It was only 8 days long between the naming and then his rejection. We also have more reporting today that Gates, it's not that he resigned. He was resigned by Trump.
Oh, he's fired.
Well, Trump just told him Trump told him he didn't have enough votes, and that was it. Now, it is important because it puts a dent in the notion that Trump is an invulnerable Superman. It also raises questions about what the real will of the Senate is going to be. And we don't know. I would guess, and it's only a guess, this is the only cabinet nominee that's not going to be confirmed, though Hegseth, the defense secretary, is getting a lot of bad publicity. But I'm not sure, you know, that we're talking about a real Senate revolt here by any means. If push came to shove, there were perhaps maybe a half dozen Republican senators that were needed or that were ready to vote against Gates. I'm not sure that you're going to get, you know, less than 51 for the other ones, but we don't know that yet.
Well, we're going to go along with you, but this is a step too far. But what does it mean in terms of, as you just said, we're getting a lot of coverage about Hegseth, and apart from what a wacko he is, people are also stressing, at least in the media, about he has zero experience running the department.
But the media doesn't run the Senate. The Senate runs the Senate, and the Senate is loyal to Donald Trump. Susan Collins claims that she did not vote for Trump. Lisa Murkowski is pretty solid in her anti-Trump positions. Mitch McConnell was among those who would not have confirmed him, but Mitch McConnell has nothing to lose. He's going to retire in 2 years.
He's completely unreliable, too. You know, he called Trump on the presidency and then voted against his impeachment.
So this might have been, they might have shot their wad with this. And I think that the Republicans, for the moment at least, don't forget that these confirmation hearings will not take place till February or March. Now, that is a long time for the accumulation of a lot of bad publicity, but bad publicity doesn't necessarily move Senate votes. So we don't know. My guess is that the Senate is going to back Trump, you know, 99%. And this is maybe the 1 or 2%. You know, with the Gates nomination, he was really trying to run roughshod over one of the few powers that remain in the Senate. And I think the Senate was very reticent to give up, to surrender that power immediately. However, the Senate is loyal to Donald Trump. And I don't think that in the coming months, they're going to want to inflict any more damage on him, because they're part of the gang. Now, Trump not having a mandate, you know, we're talking about the difference of 1% or 2% of the vote.
Yeah, let's go. Before you do that, Mark, can I just, trying to look it up. I know you have too, and it is a very big deal to see what this mandate is, because it's absolutely true that he has a trifecta, but there's less than about 2% difference between them. I looked today at the Cook report and it says 49.87% for Trump and 48.25% for Kamala Harris. It's at about 1.62 or 1.67% different.
Point and a half.
Yeah.
But we have an electoral college,
Well,
and
this.
I'll remind you that Donald Trump won the 2016 election, even though his opponent got several million more popular votes. So statistically, I think this has a bigger effect on the House and a smaller effect on the Senate because they're dependent on voters. Trump isn't. I hate to put it in longer term perspectives, but I think we need to. After the midterms, he's going to be an official lame duck. And if those midterms do not come out favorable to him, if he loses the House, which he probably will, but not necessarily, it might filter up to the Senate that if he's losing voters, they're losing their guarantee of sinecure. It's one thing to tie yourself, to lash yourself to this bombastic rhetoric of radical change that Trump is talking about. It's one thing to do that while he's campaigning and as he gets elected. It's another thing to think about as his term goes into lame duckness and he cannot run again.
So he says he's even he raised the question. Of course, you're right.
I mean, people are saying, look, you got a lot of scared Democrats out there who are raising all kinds of bizarre scenarios. Some of them may come true because we're living in a bizarre world. There was some reporting today about on Twitter that, Elon Musk might buy MSNBC. But, MSNBC as we know it, it's,
NBC, yes.
well, it's not going to be NBC. It's been spun off by Comcast. And MSNBC and CNBC are now going to be a separate entity that's up for sale. Meanwhile, the viewership of MSNBC has dropped about 40% since the elections, because you have a lot of Democrats who believed that watching and listening to everything that was terrible about Donald Trump was somehow going to defeat Donald Trump, and it didn't. So you've got discouraged, disaffected, rudderless Democrats out there scared to death.
You
And
also have, by the way, what I said in the beginning, this, if people forgot what it was like, in those 4 years, the daily barrage of chaos and lies and
well, also,
jokes and
also,
all the rest of it, it's exhausting.
well, also, Donald Trump won the youth vote. And one of the reasons he won the youth vote is that kids who were 18 or 19 years old were 10 years old when he came to power in 2016. That's apart from the fact that most people pay no attention to politics in any case. And
And if
that's
they do, they listen to podcasts and not to the, legacy media.
Well, that's the fix that the Democrats have put themselves in, generally speaking, because Trump has been on the offensive, and the Democrats are on, have been on the defensive by defending government institutions that really do not work very well or that are not efficient. That's not an excuse for eliminating Medicare and Medicaid and food stamps, which the Republicans want to do. But dissatisfaction with large government institutions is bipartisan. But the Democrats were put themselves in a position because they did not have a proactive program that people could feel because they were not in the communities that they talk about. And other issues like putting race over class, which has completely backfired on them. Because of that, they became the establishment. And I don't agree with you that people listen to a lot of podcasts. The 20% of the American population or less that has a strong interest in politics listens to political podcasts. Most people don't listen or read anything that's political. they hear things. They hear broad ideas from their neighbors, from their friends, from 2 minutes on the radio or 5 minutes on television. Don't forget, even Fox, its nightly viewership is usually around 2 or 3 million. That's less than 1% of the population. It's not like Fox is state television and the only channel. In fact, that might be better in a way because people would have to watch it and rebel against it. The problem is that there's 350 channels of entertainment, and politics does not rank very high.
It's so interesting you're bringing all this up because Dan Rather, as you probably saw, wrote a piece on this election not being so much a failure of the Democrats, but a failure of the media that has been captured by the far right media. And so he calls it propaganda. We can call it misinformation. And that most people, as you say, they may tune in on the radio when they're driving, maybe not, but they hear things. And reliably, more people listen to what Fox, Sinclair, all of these right wing media outlets. So they don't really have a good sense, I would think, at least from what he's saying, about what was really
an issue. Yeah, but blaming the media. The media is a nice, fat, rich target. There's a lot to be said about it that's negative and critical. But you're a student of history and a professor of history, and you know that the most, I guess, perhaps the most outstanding example is, you know, there was no MSNBC during the Russian Revolution. There wasn't even an opposition press to speak of, right? So people can act without the media. The problem is that in the United States, which is a profoundly apolitical country and one that has profound absence of long-standing political institutions from the bottom up, we do not have active political parties. The parties appear for a couple of months every 2 or 4 years, and then they vanish. When I lived in Italy, in a town of 25,000 people, there was a socialist party presence. There was a Christian Democratic presence. There was a Communist Party presence. There was there were actually communities built by these parties at the base. I'm not sure that's still the case in Italy.
But it's also, I'm going to just interrupt you for a half a second because, to agree with you, and I want to say, we're going to come back to this question about little forms of democracy, let's call it. But you're absolutely right. And I lived in Britain, and even there, they have parliamentary democracy with various parties, but they do have a first past the post system, which is a winner take all system. So as long as you have that, it's down to basically two parties, and it's what we would call a rigged system. So we can get into all of that. But before we do, Mark, I want to go back to where we began, which is essentially on the appointments and the election. Just to say that you started out by saying, and so did I, that the margin of victory is narrower than what he first proclaimed. And I get the question. Here's the question. The question is, do you think that Trump would be the kind of president to proceed cognizant that the that there's a small margin, or as the appointment goes for broke and just, you know, it goes all out?
Trump is completely reckless. You notice that, you know, within 15 minutes of Matt Gaetz resigning, he had another candidate who is arguably worse in
because
some ways.
Because she's more competent.
Yes, because she will absolutely be confirmed. But she's an election denier. She was a lobbyist for Qatar, you know, which is the home of Hamas. You know, that might raise a few questions. She's been terrible on all of the most regressive issues that have characterized Florida for the last 4 years. So there's nothing redeeming about her. She might have a greater respect for rule of law than Matt Gaetz did, but marginally. So
also, because she, it's up to her interpretation. I listened to an interview with her this morning about her changing position on gay people, whether she stands with them or whether she doesn't. And she said, of course, she's sympathetic or something, but she has to follow the Constitution of the state of Florida.
Yeah, well, all of this is hot air. Yeah. Because none of these people have any agency whatsoever. This government's going to be run by Donald Trump. And these people are there to take orders from him. And they're not going to do anything significant without getting his approval first. So without overblowing it, you're looking at a presidential dictatorship, perhaps within the frame of an American democracy. That is to say, it doesn't mean that he's going to shut down Congress or shut down this or shut down that. Might shut down the Department of Education, and then we'd lose a great wrestling entrepreneur as the cabinet secretary.
I was trying to think last night if she's worse than DeVos.
But these are all irrelevant. These are all irrelevant questions because power is in the hands of the president.
Okay. Let me ask you this as you're considering this, because Democrats, Chris Murphy said on the Bulwark this morning, he said, you know, they're worried about whether or not there's going to be arrest warrants now for members of Congress, shutdowns of the nonprofit organizations that tried to cross Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And he says he's legitimately worried and crossing his fingers that maybe there'll be a normal world, but somehow he fears. We're going to be in a big dystopia.
I think the dystopia has already began. I think that people have to be very clear what we're looking at and what needs to happen. You're looking at a president who is going to retain all power. There's not going to be any cabinet secretary, no matter who it is, that's going to have any independence or any agency. I am also sure that the Department of Justice will be his political police. Don't forget the number two and three positions in the new Justice Department are going to his personal attorneys. Pam Bondi was also his personal attorney during the impeachment, and she was an election denier in 2020, and she raised a bunch of phony issues about rigged elections. So the Justice Department is captured already by Trump.
And is this a step worse than it, in your imagination, let's say, worse than it was under Barr, because he had a few guardrails left?
No, much worse. In fact, however, you saw that even in Trump 1, there were top justice officials that they tried to get in any case and failed. This time they won't fail because the top leadership, at least the top leadership, is all his personal attorneys. So one could mock the first Trump Justice Department and say, he thinks it's like his personal attorney. Well, this time it is his personal attorneys. Okay. The point that I'd like to make is the following. Americans don't have experience with authoritarian governments or dictatorships. They don't know what they are. They're about to learn. And I would say this, that to try and tie some of things together, the question of him not having a mandate, to me, the most important part of that is for his opposition to get up off the floor and stop pulling their hair out, thinking that they're surrounded by a 2-to-1 margin of MAGA against them. Those who oppose Trump are roughly the same number of people who support him, right? His policies are highly contradictory because he wants to be popular. He's promised not to touch Medicare and Medicaid, et cetera. And he's got Elon Musk and his lunatic partner promising to cut these social programs. Also, Trump,
Marjorie Taylor Greene now is part of the.
She's going to be a head of a congressional subcommittee that will oversee the phantom agency that Elon Musk is running, but it doesn't exist.
Just one question for our listenership, Mark. They're talking about this as a governmental agency that will newly be created and funded by?
Well, it would have to be created by Congress, and I doubt if it will be. This is a way to have Elon Musk be basically a co-president and a funder of opposition to Republicans who vote against Trump. In other words, if somebody in the House or the Senate really gets out of line, it doesn't take much to get a phone call and say, well, Elon Musk, they won't use his name. It's not going to be hard to put $50 million against you in the primary because you're a rhino. So the thought I want to finish is that the lack of a mandate should give some encouragement to those who oppose Trump that they're not submerged in a world of MAGA. MAGA controls the government and will control the government and will commit excesses and will move the country toward at least illiberal democracy, if not authoritarian rule or dictatorial rule, presidential dictatorial rule. He doesn't need to change the structure of the three powers because he controls them all.
Exactly. He's captured them and they're subservient, even
right.
If you get
but
10 or 15 senators.
But the problem he faces is the economic question, because he has promised an economic improvement, which has no power to do. He cannot lower the price of gasoline. He cannot lower the price of eggs. The Congress could theoretically raise the minimum wage, but that's not going to happen.
This is a very good discussion. So continue on the mandate, because it obviously brings up the question of opposition.
Right. But what it means is that the opposition has to realize two things. Number one, the resistance, as it was called, from 2017 to 2024, was a complete and total failure. Okay, it didn't work. Marching in pink pussycat hats didn't mean a damn thing because it left no organization. The resistance was basically a hashtag resistance carried out on Twitter primarily and Facebook to another degree.
I will say, Mark, that the initial demonstration was very impressive in terms of its size, but
until the day after.
Well, that's the point, obviously.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give a little credit to the fact that it was here in L.A.
Well, we can give credit to it, but we also have to understand that it failed. And the Democratic strategy has failed, and it's been failing for 3 decades or more.
And that's where really, if I could just interrupt, where we need to go, because I've just done 2 programs that essentially are postmortems on the Democratic strategy, which, you know, was a big mistake. I know you hold the position that it wouldn't have really mattered much, but it does matter now, because you see, as the Democratic Party decides to, you know, have a postmortem themselves and see, you know, if they're going to double down on this failed, Clintonite, Obamaite, neoliberal appeal to suburbanites and professionals.
And I don't think that's even, I think the problem is much, much deeper than that.
Well, can I just add one point to it? Because there was an article this morning that I read about, let's say, Claudia Sheinbaum in Mexico. And the first thing that she's continuing from AMLO is raising the minimum wage. So it started out at $4 an hour, and then it went up to 14. And now she's instituting something that would never be, you wouldn't be able to do here, which is price control. So milk can't go above this fat, eggs can't be more than this, and gas can't be
but
more than that.
Susie, the MAGA Congress is not going to impose price controls. Okay, so let's stick to reality. The reality is, the Democratic Party is flat on its back. It has no idea what to do. There's 10 or 15 different recipes out there for what Democrats should do or didn't do. And none of that makes a bit of difference right now. Okay.
What it makes does it in terms of the way they go forward.
Well, allow me to finish the thought, okay, which is that it makes no difference. They can say how they're going to go forward, but there's one element missing, and that's called the people. The Democratic Party is as divorced from the people as the Republican Party is. And Democrats are naive in believing that electing this or that person to, say, a leadership position, or that a faction of the Democrats are going to move the party to the left or to the right, all of that is fantasy. We've seen that happen in 2016 with Bernie Sanders. We saw it 2020 with the BLM marches, et cetera. All of that has backfired. Okay? It didn't fail. It backfired.
And it was abandoned as well by Kamala Harris in this campaign. I mean,
yeah,
but
you've got it backwards. I don't care what Kamala Harris abandons or adopts. What I care is what are people who are going to vote Democratic, and we'll get to that in a moment about why they have no choice except to vote Democratic. Right. But the anti-Trump forces have to see themselves as an independent movement that is strong enough and that has enough electoral power that whether it's Kamala Harris or the man in the moon, who's the Democratic candidate, has to be obligated to include them in their agenda because they have mobilized. As long as we keep looking upward and saying, well, if Kamala had done this, if Biden had done that, if Bernie Sanders had done this, is a complete and total waste of time. The question is, what are you doing? What are we doing? What organizations are we building? And the question is, so what do you do, right? Well, first of all, you brace yourself and you eliminate all wish casting, right? You take the texts that come from you from Chuck Schumer asking him to sign the No Kings Act and you line your canary cage with him. Chuck Schumer has no power. Okay. The Democratic Senate has no power unless that filibuster stays in place, which I don't think it will.
I don't either. I think Republicans will get rid of it and then we'll see what happens in the future.
Yeah, well, if the filibuster isn't gotten rid of, Trump can't pass any legislation.
And it's an interesting question that you raise that because Trump promised that he would be a dictator on day one, maybe only for a day, but that he would, how did he say it, put an end to democracy on the first day. What you're laying out, Mark Cooper, is the way that Trump has captured the government and he can continue with the institutions in place because they won't be a threat to him.
Right. Well, he's going to modify them. He's going to disempower them. And the American people have to be prepared for the worst, okay? And stop diddling themselves by saying, oh, well, there's this petition, or this guy made this statement, or I heard this on MSNBC, or, you know, Chuck Schumer sent me a text, or Kamala Harris is doing this or that. None of that matters. We're in for some very rough times. And people have to be ready to resist and for real, okay?
And to organize.
But to organize in real life, not with hashtags. The hashtags can work to bring people together. But unless those hashtags produce real human bodies who are organized with real agendas that reach out beyond the Democratic circle, then you might as well forget it, right? You have to have economic and social program that is attractive to a broad majority of the country. Because when we talk about class now, and we talk about the working class, much of the working class has advanced degrees and make $30,000 a year by sitting in a cubicle. It's not just blue-collar workers in a steel mill. the Democrats, but not just the Democrats, the grassroots of the center left have to give up the notion that a racial appeal works over a class appeal. And the proof of that is, oh, everybody can't imagine. Why? Why are all these black people and why are all these Latino people voting Trump? Well, they're voting Trump for the same reason that the white working class is voting Trump, because they're suffering the same economic problems that white workers face.
Let me come in on that before you continue, Mark, because there's just otherwise I'll forget it for later. But that is that you mentioned, you know, Elon Musk sort of being like the co-president. And it's very clear that Trump and Musk are going to cross swords fairly quickly when it comes to policy on China, when it comes to fossil fuels versus electric cars and pushing that sort of thing. So I don't know how long it's going to last. And I certainly don't think that government efficiency is anything other than an excuse to take down what Trump calls the administrative state. But in terms of being in for a rough ride, and on the other hand, that what you just said, that people voted for Trump because they felt that he was somehow going to improve the economy. He'll take it back before the pandemic and the prices are going to come down, and he's not going to be able to deliver on that. And in fact, if he does his tariffs, things are going to get a lot worse. So what we're left with, you know, and this is where I want to go with you, because it's a bundle of contradictions. And Trump has, at least in his rallies and everything else, he's been vitriolic in stoking up the worst kind of xenophobia and racism and threatening mass deportations that apparently a lot of the public agrees with. So when you say rough time, you're talking economically, politically, or are you also talking about being witness to police in the streets rounding up people, throwing them out?
Yeah, I think that's a real possibility. I think people should believe what Trump says. I think that we need to understand this is a long-term project, okay? This is not something, you know, even if two or three of these cabinet members are magically turned down, and I don't think they will be, that's not going to change a damn thing, okay? Trump is going to do what he's going to do. Now, unfortunately for Donald Trump, and unfortunately for us, Donald Trump holds all power, but he's crazy. And he's erratic and he's impaired. So he makes very bad decisions, and he makes them impetuously. He makes them without thinking about the consequences, because he doesn't ask and he doesn't listen. So right now, the best thing the Democrats got going for them is Donald Trump. I mean that sort of sarcastically and sort of ironically. Yes, Donald Trump can fail on his economic message, and people can become disaffected by that. But they have to have somewhere to go. They have to have an alternative. And right now, the Democrats do not offer the alternative, not because of the cheap criticism that, oh, they're too centrist, they're too soft, they're too... No, the Democrats are too remote from their own base. They don't work in the communities they talk about, right?
Well, what we have, and this is absolutely right, we have a party structure that, as you said in the beginning, is really more like an electoral coalition that comes together at the time of elections, but during the rest of the time does not have an infrastructure that is like a party that has meetings, that has youth groups, except that has a connection.
But MAGA does. Okay? MAGA has a social movement, and the left does not have, forget about the left. The left in the middle and the center has none. The only real active social movement in this country is MAGA. And until we can counter MAGA with our own social movements, then we have something to talk about. During the election, you had the debate of people who said, well, much of what I'm saying, well, the Democrats don't do anything and yada, yada. Therefore, I'm going to vote for the Green Party or for Cornel West. Peace and Freedom Party. Well, you know, I was a candidate for the Peace and Freedom Party in 1970 when I was 19 years old. I was too young. But These are non-existent parties, okay? These are little grouplets. And in our system, they have zero power. So the question is, how do you take this centered left grievance and turn it into political power, right? You don't do it by voting for the Green Party, because we've seen that the Green Party doesn't exist outside of the electoral cycle. And it doesn't have one single elected statewide representative in the country, right? The way you look at it is you compare our democracy to a parliamentary democracy of the sort they have in Europe. And there, nobody expects to get 50% of the vote, right? You have a left, whether it is, you have a left party or a green party or a socialist party, and they're in coalition with similar parties or with more centrist parties or parties to their left, right? We have to think of our system where we have two parties. We have to think about us being a third party as a social movement that becomes a reasonably large faction or influence inside the Democratic Party, right? Because there's no alternative to that. If anybody who thinks that in the next 5 or 10 years, there's going to be some constitutional amendment that's going to do away with the Electoral College, or that's going to create the grounds for third party, they're out there, just don't know what they're talking about.
Well, this is a giant question, and it's the one that we raise every time. Of course, we have a system that is a flawed democracy. We have a formal democracy that's content is hollowed out by various so-called checks, like the Electoral College, like the Senate, which has got two from every state, no matter the size. But also, the biggest thing is the winner-take-all system, which, you know, by the way, it's not enshrined in the Constitution.
So
these
what?
Are rules that can be changed.
Yeah, who's going to change them?
Well, this is the point, Mark, that, you know, you're talking about European parliamentary democracy, and our democracy in the United States, let's say, and elsewhere in the world, is formal but hollowed out. And I would argue that the biggest reason that it's hollowed out is not the structure, but the influence of money. So long as you have or Citizens United, so long as you have unfettered money coming in, then you cannot have.
Well, then we might as well give up. I mean, if you want a list,
you don't have that in Europe, though. You're talking about places where
we don't live in Europe. We live in the United States.
No, but you're talking about these forms of parliamentary democracy that are more democratic, and especially if they have proportional representation. This is absolutely true.
Right.
It is the best form that we have, but it's still not genuine democracy.
Well, you know, Susie, I have a Chevrolet, but I'd like to have a Mercedes-Benz, you know. We can talk about utopia or we can talk about principles. Now, I think the problem that the center left has is an ideological problem, because they also have a winner take all position. Like, if we don't win, then we lost. And that's ridiculous, because the left is never going to govern this country by itself. There's 100 million evangelicals. Do you think they're going to join your socialist party? I don't think so. You have to look at the formation. I'll give you a concrete example. Okay. After the Bernie thing, right, you had the flocking of membership to the DSA. The DSA was originally inside the Democratic Party, but it was very small. When it became big, it decided that they were too good to be Democrats, per se. And they moved mostly outside of the Democratic Party and wound up, you know, creating an international committee that mimicked the Communist Party of 1930, right?
Well, many different committees. It was completely decentralized so that every, you know, local was different than the others.
So all I'm saying is that if you look at the original intent or the original potential of the DSA, which I now believe to be a completely ineffective organization, the original principle is that you organize a left or a center left that is a mass movement that engages in the Democratic Party, not with the intention of moving the party to the left, because they're not going to be a majority. You have to be realistic and say, we're going to be big enough and we're going to be strong enough that the rest of the people in the Democratic Party have to pay attention to us. We saw this with Biden in his first year, right? In March of 21, a month or two after he was elected, he sat down with Bernie Sanders and he said to Sanders, we're going big, right? Because he understood that at that point, which is not today, the Sanders movement, if you will, or the Sanders influence was strong enough that Biden had to accommodate to that. And he did in the first year. He passed, from an economic point of view, some of the most progressive legislation since FDR, right? That lasted about a year. The problem is...
Yeah, and you have to finish that sentence. It wasn't because he didn't want to continue with it. It was sabotaged by Sinema and Manchin and his own party.
And the Republicans. But Manchin and Sinema were a stand-in for probably 15 or 20 other...
Exactly, the other blue dogs that we don't call them that anymore. But
15 or 20 other Democrats who didn't want to take down the filibuster either.
Let me come in on this, Mark, because you're saying a lot and it resonates with me. And I think what you're talking about, on the one hand, is also the limits of this system. We're talking about the existence of democracy, which, after all, is pretty young. And I think we have to say that the weakening of democracy goes along with the weakening of the labor movement. If we look at all of the advances, like universal franchise, like workers' rights, like all of the things that were won that we consider part of advanced bourgeois democracy today were won by struggles in the labor movement and socialists within the labor movement pushing for them. They made democracy more democratic. And now we see, you know, that the other side has pushed, and I know you're laughing, but the other side, you know, has pushed privatization plus immigration. That has been the sort of counter to the growing weight of the working class and organized labor, let's say. And we're left with this decline. And those people who are voting for right-wing authoritarians, not just here, but around the world, are those who've lost status, who are left behind, who see, you know, the other party is non-responsive to their issues. And what you get in the authoritarians like Trump, and Trump plus Musk is charisma plus money.
Well, yeah, we know this, right? We know this. So what do? We understand that we need to build a multiracial coalition that is proactive, that is attractive, that is deeply connected to its communities, that is based in its communities. And then after we do that, we can worry about how we do or do not fit in the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party is not coming to save any of us, right? It's not going to do it. The Senate isn't going to do it. The courts aren't going to do it. The only people who are going to do it are us, or we're going to fail. It means that people have to get really serious and understand that hashtag resistance doesn't work, that dividing people into racial categories does not work. And the only thing that works is the movement that addresses the direct needs of the overwhelming majority of the population. The reason that the Latino vote dropped is because they're workers. They get up in the morning and the first thing that the Latino says to himself is not, hey, I'm a BIPOC. They say, hey, I got to be at work by 8 o'clock. And I hope right I can, and I have to pay the rent at the end of the month, right? And the
so
fact.
Let's go there, Mark. We don't have time to solve all the problems of organization.
No.
But we saw with the rise of the Sanders movement and with young people everywhere who have been really active in the last period, not right now for this election, but there is a groundswell with expectation that has failed to coalesce in the kind of organization you could say that would challenge or even be able to make inroads. A lot of people say that, you know, that when the Schumer, Pelosi, and the older generation in the Democratic Party all retires, that the younger people are going to come in and they're going to make it better. I don't know. I don't know if that's true, but I do know Trump is targeting nonprofits. And I think nonprofits are the very organizations that sprung up when working class organizations weren't there. And I also see in the last several years, we have seen spectacular strikes and a new feeling about organized labor. There, people admire it, want to be part of it. It's no longer thought of, you know, in the way that it was before. And these are signs of hope.
And who do you who do you think Trump is going to appoint to the National Labor Relations Board?
Somebody awful.
Well, 6% of the private sector is unionized. That's nothing. The other 4 or 5% are government workers, and some of them are already stripped of collective bargaining, and the ones that aren't will be within the next year or so. All I'm trying to say is that we are confronting a form of authoritarianism that's going to require hard work and real sacrifice. And it's not too early for people to learn to be trained in civil disobedience, because you don't take down dictatorships or authoritarian governments with hashtags. Okay? You don't take them down with rock concerts. You don't take them down with endorsements from celebrities.
But you do in the kinds of strikes that have been waged, even though it doesn't involve the entire labor movement. These are really good signs, Mark, and they have led to backing down on the part of the various industries that have been struck.
Yeah, except Trump got elected. So, and he also took the Senate and the House. So I don't really understand what you're saying. What you're saying is that a small percentage of the 5% that is unionized, or 6%, one or two unions in particular have shown some real gumption over the last couple of years. We also had the head of the Teamsters Union addressing the Republican National Convention, right? So, yes, unionization is important, but unionization at this point is not the antidote.
I'm not talking about the union bureaucracy. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the actions of young workers who want to act and who want to flex their muscles.
Right. Well, that's the kind of stuff that we need to support. That's the kind of stuff we need to build, certainly within the labor movement, but not just in the labor movement. It has to be the citizenry, capital C, that comes into action and understands that sulking and crying about this and laying on the floor in a puddle of tears and pulling their hair out is not going to do anything. This is a long-term problem. And there's no guarantee that Trump will lose the midterm elections. If he does, then you have a whole new ballgame. If he wins the midterm elections, you have postseason games, which are going to be even more important because he's going to have totally unbridled power.
We have to start to wrap up, Mark, and I just wanted to ask you to bring it back around. Many people are concerned that we have elected a fascist who will nonetheless use all of the institutions that are now subservient to him within the government, and who has threatened to go after those parts of the population that he either wants to eradicate for fascist reasons or that he considers opponents, not just within Congress, but also so-called nonprofits and others. We also know with experience from Trump that our best hope is his incompetence and his ability to alienate those who are closest to him and then to fire them. And so the question, I guess, for you, could spin a crystal ball, is how successful do you think Trump will be? And do you think that he'll stir up enough opposition?
I don't know how successful he will be. I know that for the moment, he's got absolute power. He also has the Supreme Court, who has legalized any illegal action that he's going to take. You know, this is not a joke. This is the real thing. And it's easy to make fun of Trump, and it's okay to make fun of Trump, and it's okay to count to a degree on his incompetence. But I would not stake my life or the life of the country on his stupidity, because that can cut two different ways, right? He has to face a broad citizens' movement in favor of defending and building out democratic institutions to confront him. And that confrontation doesn't happen online, and it doesn't happen on television. Okay? It happens in real life, as they say, online. That can take many forms. That can be letter writing. That can be organizing in your local community. It can be connecting with whatever local labor there is. It can mean salting workplaces to create labor unions. It can mean civil disobedience when that becomes necessary. And if anybody believes that's not going to become necessary, it's because they've never lived under a dictatorship or an authoritarian government. Americans are still in la-la land. And that's why I said to you that the most important thing about him not having a mandate is the psychological impact on his opposition. Right. He's going to claim he has a mandate because he's got a trifecta. And he does have a trifecta. He's right about that. Whether it's 49.9 or 50.1 doesn't really matter. What matters is that the people who are opposed to Trump, we need to be organized. Right. And a lot of those MAGA voters were last minute voters. They were kids. They were young people who surged on the last day. 12% of his voters made their decision on election day because they never voted before, or they didn't know what Trump 1.0 was, right? They had no idea. They're walking around with nothing in their heads. So we have to also be able to catch those people. And the worst way to catch them is to hit them with outdated, obsolete leftist rhetoric that means nothing to them. Means absolutely nothing. It's a different language. And we need to be connected to them rather than be floating above them in some infrastructure, which, yes, is paid for by big money. Big money is not all powerful unless you invest all of your political activity into that electoral arena. Then, yes, it makes a big difference. But the money doesn't mean anything if you have enough votes, if you have enough consciousness, if you have enough engagement by the citizens to say, we're not going to stand for this. And I'm nobody to say this, but I'll say it. If people aren't willing to do that, then get the hell out of the way and stop distracting us, because you're not doing anything. You're wasting your time and you're wasting our time.
Mark Cooper, thank you for all of that. That's, you know, something that I'm going to have to follow up with you on, let's say, several months down the road to see where we are and to see what kind of a groundswell will emerge. And hopefully we'll be able to organize the kind of opposition that we all need and that you're talking about. Mark Cooper is a veteran journalist, former staff writer at The Nation. He retired from USC as a journalism professor and has written several books, but right now, you can get his writing on a daily, weekly, basis at The Coop Scoop. That's thecoopscoop.substack.com. And you really should, because it's not only politically important, but it's also fun to read. So, Mark, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right.
And that's our show for today. I'd like to thank my guest, Mark Cooper. Thanks also to executive producer Robert Brenner, producer-director Melissa Figueroa, editor, engineer, Juliana Gota, and Gary Baca in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows, as well as subscribe to the podcast at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. More information on programs and guests are on our Facebook page. That's Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. You've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond. Streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening and stay tuned. I'm Susie Wiseman.
Hi, I'm John Santana. Next time on CinemaScore, musical scores composed for films but rejected by their director, like Alex North's score for 2001. Composer Jerry Goldsmith did not approve.
I was more particularly offended in the film itself, you know, the Blue Danube Waltz in that section. I was offended with all the music, the way it was used, and particularly that.
Sunday evening at 5 here on KPFK.